This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. As we get through one holiday after the other, whether you celebrate them or not, the food and treats seem to be beckoning from all over the place. As soon as fall weather hits, it's pumpkin spice lattes and apple cider donuts, hot cocoa and s'mores, or if you're into savory foods, roasted turkey and cheese mashed potatoes. And that's not taking into account the cultural comfort foods you may find yourself indulging in as well. Food is necessary for us to survive, but how does food become something that can be detrimental to our health? Joining us now is Ashley Gearhart, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab. Thank you so much for joining us, Ashley.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Ashley, the holidays always get me in the mood for comfort food. And these days, there are so many new things on store shelves that catch my attention, whether it's a pumpkin spice cereal or some new flavored jelly beans that happen to go with whatever the theme is that particular month. Yeah. There's always something new to try. Is this by design?
Absolutely. It's by design. As humans, we're really designed to pay attention to variety in our food. If we get sick of eating the same thing over and over again, and this was kind of baked in to make sure we were getting lots of different foods with lots of different nutrients. But the foods that are in our food environment now are almost all ultra processed foods that are just chemical concoctions, high in sugars and fats and salts. And they can really be manipulated by the industry. So they have these chemical and artificial flavors, like the pumpkin spice is an actual pumpkin spice. It's a chemical flavor to make you kind of think of pumpkin spice. And so they can take the sugar, fat, and salt that we also find wildly appealing and just make it, sell it, market it, make the flavors come in so many different sizes and packages so our brain never gets sick of it.
We hear the comparison a lot when it comes to things that are addictive, whether it's social media or video games and even food, being compared to cigarettes and smoking. When it comes to food, what is it that makes it addictive?
Yeah, so with food, food is really what our brain pays attention to naturally. So much of the reward and the motivation systems in our brain really evolved to help us get enough food, get enough calories. It was one of the biggest threats to survival. And because of that, our brain pays a lot of attention to ingredients that have a lot of calories, things like sugars and fats. And the taste that signal that you're going to get a high calorie ingredient, like sweetness or savoriness in your mouth. And so, this really helped us when food wasn't very accessible and, for sources of sugar were rare and the kind of highest sugary thing you could hope to get was some berries or, scaling to go into a beehive to get some honey. And so our brain sits up and pays attention to those things. Well, just like we've done with other addictive substances, we've gotten really good at stripping out and refining and processing. So we have these highly potent versions of high calorie ingredients like the sugars and the fats in our world. And so now rather than eating an apple to get sugar, we're eating things where it's purely refined sugar combined with fats, combined with flavorings, combined with salt in this rapidly processed package. And that is just something our brain never evolved to handle. It's so powerful. And it really activates reward and motivation systems in the brain in a way that really mimics what happens with drugs of abuse.
Wow, that's it's kind of scary to think about because I'm just thinking how this morning I was just like, okay, I'm just going to have like one Oreo, dip it in my coffee. Just I need something sweet. And I feel like I've set myself up for failure today.
I would say to be compassionate with yourself that it's not black or white. It's not like you eat one food and you're off to the races. But I do think it is important to hold that these foods are engineered and designed for us to struggle to eat them in moderation. The industry is a $1 trillion industry and it has lots of research and development. And a lot of that money goes into engineering foods that they describe as inducing moorishness, which means you always want more and more and more. And they're hitting your bliss point. And they try and really make you develop these appealing, positive attitudes towards these foods from the moment you're even a little kid and through their huge marketing budgets. And so it can really set up that situation that if you're just trying to rely on, am I hungry? Am I full? These foods don't do a great job of hitting our satiety signals, and they do a really good job of setting us up so we are in this state of kind of constantly wanting more. That's why they even use that in some of their marketing. You know, once you pop, you can't stop. This idea that it's really a challenge to put the brakes on when you start eating these foods.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can relate to trying things and then be like, wait, I want more, even though I'm so full.
Absolutely.
But can you tell us a little bit about ultra processed foods and what makes them so addictive? I know you're mentioning like the sugars and the fats and stripping some of this stuff down. But what is an ultra processed food versus a processed food?
Yeah. So ultra processed foods are something that is really pretty novel in human history. You know, we really go back to about the 1980s when these ultra processed foods really started to skyrocket. And what they are they're industrial compilations, often of kind of chemically based ingredients that you wouldn't find in your home kitchen. So if you, you know, look at the ingredient label on many of the snack foods or junk foods or ready to heat foods that you buy at the grocery store, you will see chemical concoctions on there that you can't even understand. Like as a food scientist, I read them and I'm like, I have no idea what that is. I feel like I'm in chemistry class, not eating an actual food. And they're so changed and modified that you really can't even identify many of a whole food in them, an actual food item. And so a lot of advocates are pushing to not really call these foods. You know, they have more in common with cigarettes, which are these, you know, industrial chemical concoctions that rapidly deliver nicotine into your brain. These ultra-processed foods are these, you know, engineered and concocted chemical substances that rapidly deliver sugars and fats and rewarding ingredients into the brain without really providing you much in the way of nutrition. And so, you know, the most commonly consumed ultra-processed foods are things like cookies and cakes and savory snacks and sugar sweetened beverages. These sorts of things are so different even than what we make at home. And they're convenient and they're cheap and they're everywhere and they're really heavily marketed.
Are ultra processed foods a result of food companies trying to reduce their costs, let's say of putting something on a shelf and letting it be able to stay there for a month versus like a few days?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So some of the big driving forces that have really led to this explosion of ultra processed foods has been a big focus on, you know, the bottom line. A lot of our big food companies are publicly traded. And so there's this pressure to always be making more and more money and having more and more profit. And one of the best ways to do that is you start using substances, ingredients that are cheaper and cheaper, but mimic the effects of actual whole foods. And so one of the examples that we have seen that plays a big role in how sweet our food environment is now is high fructose corn syrup. The actual, you know, even sugar that we had been using for hundreds of years became more expensive. And at that time, the industry pivoted to high fructose corn syrup, which is kind of chemically derived, and it's much more potently sweet and it's way cheaper for the industry to use. And because we are so attuned to sweet taste and sugars, they didn't just put it in sweet foods you'd expect, like cookies, but they put it in pretty much everything. You know, about 80% of the foods in the grocery store have some sort of added sweetener to them. And so it's in breads, it's in ketchups, it's in tomato sauces and soups, it's in everything. And that activates the brain in a way that is really enticing for us. And that also improves their bottom line. And a lot of the ingredients that are used in these ultra processed foods to help them stay shelf stable, that are, you know, kind of chemically modifying them, they don't taste great. They can have kind of a bitter taste to them. And so adding sweeteners, adding flavorants to mask the ill taste of those shelf-stable additives is also another pressure. But if you only have to stock it and it's not going to go bad and you can kind of just keep it on the shelf for months and months and months, that really helped your bottom line.
This is all sounding a little scary just thinking about it.
You know, and some of the things that's really stunning to me that I even just learned in the last few years is, you know, these ultra-processed foods, they were really developed and created by big tobacco, by, you know, the biggest creator and manufacturer
of ultra-processed foods from 1980 to about 2007 was Philip Morris, was R.J. Reynolds, were the companies that designed and created and modified cigarettes so they would get more and more addictive through their practices. They were the same people creating, that were owned Kraft and General Mills and Hawaiian Punch. And so they used a lot of the same scientific approaches, marketing approaches, strategies in these foods. And that's why, we think of ultra-processed foods as food, but again, they have way more in common with cigarettes than they do with an apple or a banana or lettuce.
Yeah, the big tobacco connection, I would say, is very eye-opening when we spoke earlier before the show about it. And I was just thinking to myself, like, how did that even come about? Like, what made big tobacco go into food?
Yeah, well, really at the time that cigarettes were kind of coming more under attack, it really made sense for those companies to diversify their portfolios. And they really did that by buying alcohol and food companies and really using substances that people naturally find enticing is good for business. And then if you already have expertise and how do we modify these products to make them even more appealing, make it so people are buying more and more and more and spending more money that way, it really made good business sense for them, but was really bad for public health.
I did want to touch upon just when we started seeing obesity and other issues related to diet becoming prominent, because it seems like it's just always been there.
When we think about our grandparents, they really weren't looking at this sort of obesity problem. And it really is in about the 1980s, at the same time that big tobacco got into food, that our food environment changed so drastically to become more and more dominated by these engineered and designed ultra processed foods, that we started to see this massive uptick in obesity. And at that same time, really, I'm a clinical psychologist. I have expertise in eating disorders. The original eating disorder that we focused on was anorexia. But in the recent times, what has become the most prominent eating disorder are eating disorders that are dominated by binging, where people lose control and they can't stop even though they want to. And they just feel like they're just shoveling food in their mouth so much, even though they're having consequences, they can't stop themselves. Those are behaviors that are really hallmarks of addiction. And we didn't start to really see that as prominently or attend to it as a field until the 1980s, which is when, bulimia nervosa started to be kind of a more prominent eating disorder, where you lose control and then you do things to purge to get rid of it. Binge eating disorder in the 2000s. So these are really kind of modern disorders that are tied closely to the changes in our food environment.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're speaking with Ashley Gearhart, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab. Before the break, we talked a little bit about the history and evolution of food and how ultra-processed foods have been impacting our lives, whether we realize it or not. Ashley, right before the break, we touched upon sort of these different eating disorders that became more prominent, I think, as our food changed. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's definitely fair to say.
And what are we seeing now? I mean, are things changing at all, addressing this, or is it still a very new field?
It's a new field. And I would say in general, things are moving slowly, but we're making progress in the science. So again, like when I first started doing this work, I'm traditionally trained as an addiction scientist, trained with eating disorders. And doing that work is when I was sitting down with individuals who had binge eating disorder, they were really describing things to me, like that loss of control and those intense cravings and knowing that they have diabetes, knowing that they were going to feel just absolutely awful after one of these binges. And it just sounded so much like that profile of addiction that I was thinking about with alcohol and cigarettes. And so I really got interested in this idea of whether these ultra processed food substances, had they crossed the line from something that was a food that was more like an apple and an orange and actually moved more into that realm of something that could trigger an addictive process that made it hard for us to listen to our bodies and to be in control of what we were eating. And so I really pivoted into food. And when we first started looking at this, myself and other scientists about, can these foods be addictive? It was really, people kind of just thought it was a silly thing to even ask, but now, it's really become a prominent focus of the addiction science field, of the obesity field, to really ask ourselves, are these foods addictive? And if they are, it really heightens the importance of using some of those policies that we have employed successfully with things like tobacco to help improve the environment and set it up so people have a better chance of success in their own health and in their children's health.
You mentioned that ultra processed foods don't provide satiety. Is there a way to do that so we can enjoy the food but get a signal to stop? Is there a way for ultra processed foods to be better?
It's possible. I'm skeptical, honestly. I would say that the industry that's creating the ultra processed foods, they don't want us to have a strong satiety signal from them. And so, often if they're adding some protein or adding some fiber, it's still done so artificially, and it removes the food so much from food that has evolved for us to be able to trust our instincts. So there's a already classic study that was done by Kevin Hall of the National Institute of Health. And he brought just kind of your average American into the National Institute of Health, and they lived there for about a month. And for about 2 weeks, those individuals lived in a food environment that was all ultra processed foods. And the food was, it was free and it was convenient and it was prepared for them, and they could order as much or as little as they wanted. And for 2 weeks, they lived in a food environment that had the same amount of calories available, same amount of macronutrients like proteins and fibers and things available to them, but it was minimally processed foods, real foods, foods our body evolved to eat and consume and moderate. And what they found is that the same person living in the ultra-processed food environment ate 500 more calories a day than they did in the minimally processed food environment, gained weight rapidly, and they weren't even aware that they were eating more. They weren't saying, oh, I'm obviously more hungry. Oh, this is happening. I'm aware of it. It was happening on this kind of subtle biological level, and we don't fully understand it. And those ultra-processed foods just weren't triggering our satiety hormones in the way that minimally processed foods do. And so I'm very skeptical that we can kind of, ultra process our way out of this issue, and that it's more about thinking of these foods with skepticism, thinking of them as a food that has a potential risk, in the same way that I think differently between, wine and beer and a glass of water, and to really kind of making our diets and our environment optimized for us to get real food in a way that's convenient, that's cheaper, that's accessible to us. Right now, our environment is always pushing us towards ultra processed foods. And those are the foods we're already prone to overeat and to struggle with.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a hard thing to battle or deal with. And especially I think for our most vulnerable populations who face food insecurity, how do these ultra processed foods affect them? For example, communities that have been historically marginalized are in food deserts. And, if they're lucky, there's a gas station with snacks and maybe they carry milk and eggs.
This is a social justice issue, without a doubt, that we see it fundamentally are, communities that have been marginalized, individuals with food insecurity. It's not just that they don't have access to the healthier foods, but they're also being swamped by marketing and pressures to eat these ultra-processed foods. There's even evidence, if you go to the same grocery store and you go to it in a high-income community versus a low-income community, the low-income community will have more ultra-processed foods, more foods that are nutritionally poor for you. And on days when people get their SNAP benefits and can actually go grocery shopping, the food environment changes, and the advertised foods, the foods on the end of the aisle that in your checkout, they increase the ones that are ultra-processed and are prone to trigger diabetes and obesity and health disease. And so fundamentally, we're operating in these different food environments. And this makes me think about times in human history where something like water was so often contaminated. And so people were drinking alcoholic substances because they were actually safer than the water that they had in their community. So people were drinking beer and wine, and children were, because that's what was safe. And so it's kind of like our most vulnerable populations are in that experience where, you know, what they have access to get calories that they need are coming packaged, and these, you know, potentially addictive substances that really provide little nutritional benefit and are very clearly tied with health consequences.
If food companies are targeting communities of color and vulnerable people with their foods, I mean, what is in it for them?
You know, it's a situation much like we saw with tobacco. You know, tobacco, you really, the playbook of going after marginalized communities, going for minority populations, is something that tobacco did because it really wanted to expand as much as possible. It's you know, the amount of smokers that it had. And we know that high amounts of stress is something that sets us up to be vulnerable for overeating these sorts of products and smoking. And so it's a group that is under a lot of systematic stress. And so they're going to be vulnerable to these sorts of substances. And there isn't political power in these neighborhoods to push back. And they're often strapped for cash, and the industry will step in and say, hey, we'll buy you this playground. We'll get you this new athletic scoreboard. And we're going to then, flood your schools with vending machines that are selling these foods that are not good for the health and well-being of your children. And so it just spreads their market share even further.
I have to say, this almost sounds like something out of like a sci-fi movie, where it's like putting things in a way that you know it's going to affect a population, but you don't really care.
Yes, it's I think fundamentally really reflective of a political system that is a little bit broken right now, where the industry has huge power when it comes to lobbying. They have they've really used the tobacco playbook to get politicians, on their side through campaign donations. They've gotten scientists on their side by funneling money to scientists to kind of muck up the scientific language to make it more confusing for folks. And if you take a step back, we now look back at many of the things. Like, I grew up in a very rural part of Ohio, and I, growing up, there was a vending machine that I could just go get cigarettes if I had wanted to. At even a very young age, it wasn't monitored. People were smoking all over the place. And it was something that we look back and we think, wow, I can't believe that we let cigarette companies target children that much, and it was so normative. With food, we're right in that. And it's different because we all have to eat. There isn't a choice to not go into the grocery store. There's not a choice to say, oh, I'm not going to put calories in my body. When the stack is so stacked against us before profits rather than health, especially if you're under-resourced, especially if you live in a community of color, it really is stunning. And I think hopefully we'll make progress and one day look back and really be surprised that we spent so many decades in this sort of environment.
When it comes to cheaper foods versus healthier alternatives, maybe it's the ingredients are cheaper for these ultra processed foods, for example, versus having fresh produce. But I feel like we do waste a lot of food in our country, and there's a lot of fresh produce that gets thrown out. So, I mean, I don't know, is there some solution in there somewhere to get fruits and vegetables in more communities versus snack foods?
Yeah, I think you're pointing to an important part of the equation, which is, the access to fruits and veggies. And you're right, like, in many ways, one of the big challenges is that those foods are actual foods, and so they go bad, our Oreos and our, packaged chips and things that can sit on our shelf forever and ever and ever. And so there are systematic challenges about making sure that they're accessible. And right now, our government investment is unfortunately imbalanced, where the largest amounts of government investment is not for fruits and veggies, but for the ingredients that go into ultra processed foods like corns and soy and things like that. And, you know, I want to really note two things that strike me as really key. The first is our evidence so far is that just getting healthy foods in without trying to also get unhealthy foods out doesn't make a ton of difference. There's evidence that as we get accustomed to eating these ultra processed foods, they change our brain in a way that those minimally processed foods that, you know, we might have really liked or found rewarding or felt motivated to consume in the past, they just don't have the same reward punch. And so if you have that, you know, bowl of grapes or that bowl of Oreos sitting right next to each other, it's hard for the bowl of grapes to compete for our desires. And so, you know, just adding in fruits and veggies into a school that is just saturated with ultra processed foods with huge marketing budgets, those foods will probably rot before kids just naturally shift over to the fruits and veggies. So we really have to think both about getting those healthy foods in, but also reducing the impact of those unhealthy foods that unnaturally grab us. And the other major thing that I think we have to be creative about, we haven't spent as much attention to, is the convenience factor. You know, a lot of what's allowed these ultra processed foods to dominate our world is that we don't have enough time. And that's just a product of the modern environment where we're all kind of hustling all the time. And so we have to think about how do we make minimally processed foods that do require more preparation time convenient to folks, especially folks who are, you know, don't have as much time, who are maybe working multiple jobs and struggling with childcare to make ends meet. And I think that the scientific community hasn't really grappled with the convenience issue as much as we need to.
Yeah, it's reminding me, when my kids were in elementary school, the school lunch program was trying to introduce more fruits and vegetables, but nobody was picking them up. It was like an extra thing. And then after school, they would try to like pass it out to everybody, like take some fruit, take some veggies. And I just kept thinking like, there's gotta be a better way because this is all ending up in the trash if nobody takes it.
Yeah. Adding the fruits and veggies is much more politically palatable, you know, but it's not sufficient to change the problem. It's necessary to have that there because we need those calories, we need those foods, but without really grappling with the hard questions about those ultra processed foods, how they trigger us, how they grab us, how they have us coming back for more, you were really not tackling the heart of the problem.
I also wonder with the way that ultra processed foods affect us, just our brains and processing things. Cause I've tried to take a break from these processed foods and eat more wholesome. And I've noticed my thinking is a lot more clear. I'm able to focus. Yeah. And how important that is for children in schools. You know, maybe they're getting breakfast and lunch at school, but is it the best for them to be able to do well?
I think you're bringing up such a good point, and one, again, that we're just starting to understand scientifically. One of the pieces of evidence recently that's been really concerning to me is that even if you take pretty healthy adults and you put them on an ultra-processed food diet for a couple weeks, you will start to see changes in their cognitive functioning and their memory, their ability to kind of have their working memory and use their executive functioning as effectively. And when we look at animal models, we see that these ultra processed foods actually damage the hippocampus in our brain, the system of the brain that plays a really key role in memory and functioning. And so again, going back to this idea of the different food environments that exist, you know, when we think about children in under-resourced communities who only have access to these sorts of foods, there's emerging evidence that that's actually setting them up to not perform as well in the cognitive domain, let alone in the affective domain of, you know, how you're feeling when you're having these sugar spikes and crashes and you're feeling tired and kind of moody and kind of irritable. You know, there's just more evidence that even though it's really hard for us to shift to these minimally processed foods because we want the ultra processed foods so much, that if we can maintain a diet that removes them, we are function better in our mood and in our cognitive capacity. But many people don't really have that option based on the environment that they operate in.
Right. And I think that again is like, what is the solution to get to a point where it's a level playing field for everybody. Yeah. And I don't know if that's more something that has to be done at the federal level or if it's locally.
You know, I think when we look back at tobacco, we saw that it was really both. You know, I think tobacco really does set up for us some really interesting lessons. And, you know, I think the lessons are that, you know, educating people is important. People deserve to know this information about, you know, the addictive nature, about the harmful nature of these products, especially when it comes to feeding their children. And that, you know, kind of setting people up to be able to get treatment is important. But really what we saw with tobacco was it took policy at local, state, and federal levels to say, you know, we're not going to let you market aggressively these damaging products to our children. We're not going to allow, you know, this to be something that children can purchase so easily. We are going to change the pricing structure around these different around tobacco to change our environment so it is less enticing. We need to set up the environment so it gives people a chance to succeed. And I think, again, we kind of feel more comfortable with just educating folks about nutrition or encouraging them to, you know, like try and go on a diet. But if our environment is so toxic that it makes it almost impossible for people to succeed, you know, we're really not tackling the heart of the problem. And then we keep the onus of blame just on the specific individual.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with Ashley Gearhart about food addiction and ultra-processed foods. I'm Miriam. So back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We've been spending the hour with Ashley Gearhart, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab. We're talking about food addiction and ultra-processed foods. And right before the break, we touched upon obesity and its relation to ultra-processed foods. We'll continue there and then get into some other discussion.
When we look at this, obesity is something that we weren't even tracking as a public health problem in the 70s. It was, you know, relatively rare, so we just weren't concerned about it, to a point now where 40% of adults have obesity. If we add overweight in there, it's actually about 75% of individuals who have overweight or obesity. It's now the dominant strain of what it's like to be in this food environment. To me, that screams that it isn't about an individual per se. You know, we are all responsible and need to make actions that support us, but we need to be in an environment that actually gives us a chance to succeed. It strikes me that it's really about changes in our environment that have led us to this point. And it has, you know, these stark issues for us of what does it mean as a society. The healthcare cost of diet-related disease are going to be a huge concern for us on an economic policy level. And when we look at even military readiness, you know, the younger generation is so unhealthy in large part due to diet and the impact of these ultra-processed foods that more and more people are getting, you know, aren't available to enter the military because their health is not at a level where they could join the armed forces. So it's really impacting us in ways that we really aren't even fully aware of in our day-to-day life.
Ashley, not to disparage any specific food choices out there, I've definitely tried so many different types of diets. But one thing I've noticed while trying to make my own healthier choices is that things advertised for vegetarians or vegans or keto friendly are often processed foods themselves. So it'll be like chips with protein, but they're still chips. And I've often felt when I've tried these different things, I'm just eating snacks all the time because it's a lot easier.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're interested in this sort of work, Michael Pollan has done some of the foundational popular press books on this. And he really says, you know, don't trust anything with a health claim, you know, because you don't see like your apples or your, you know, carrots or things like that having this big advertising of like, you know, fat-free food. Like I always laugh when I see gummy candy, like those Swedish fish. And it's like a low-fat food. Often a lot of these nutritionism sort of claims that are on these ultra-processed foods are about confusing the consumer to really think about the fact that this isn't a real food, that it's a chemical concoction that's designed to really activate your reward and motivation systems in a way that is really novel. And we don't, you know, we're seeing the consequences of that. And so for me, it's really been helpful again, to think of these, you know, ultra processed food substances as not in the same category with food. And when you look at those labels and there's, you know, ingredients and things on them that you can't even understand, you can't even pronounce, to just think about it with more skepticism. I'm not saying that, you know, the only thing people should subsist on is this black and white diet where, you know, you're only eating, you know, black beans and kale and that's it. You know, that's not what I think we need to take to heart per se, but that it is that, you know, the majority of our diet, the kind of default of our diet should be real food. And that we should know when we are eating these foods, even if they have all these health claims on them, to treat them with a skeptical eye towards their potential health consequences and their potential addictive nature.
What about alternatives to things like sugar? Over the years, I've gone down the rabbit hole of, oh, we're going to use agave or maple syrup or coconut sugar. But is sweetness just sweetness? And it doesn't really matter where it comes from. It's still going to be addictive.
Yeah, the brain, you know, really, there's maybe a little bit of differences here and there. Like there's some evidence with high fructose corn syrup, the way it impacts the liver is particularly damaging. But at the end of the day, when it comes to the reward centers of the brain, you know, caloric sweeteners just make our brain sit up and pay attention. You know, we come out of the womb liking sweetness and finding it powerful. You know, we're designed to want that because it really encouraged us to consume, you know, our mother's milk and make sure we survived. You know, sugar is so powerful when you're a baby that we actually use sweet taste to replace opioids for some minor surgeries for babies. You'll give them a little dose of sugar and it's so effective at, you know, releasing opioids in the brain that they'll use it for circumcisions or shots or minor dental surgeries for young kids. And so kind of, yeah, whether it's, you know, a coconut sweetener or agave or whatever, at the end of the day, you know, added sweeteners and other, you know, refined carbohydrates are something I pay a lot of attention to because, you know, things like processed flours and starches that are really processed, that just gets converted into sugar in your body. And so when we're getting sugar from something like a banana or an apple and those naturally occurring products, it comes with fiber and waters and acids, and it doses and it weighs that it's delivered so slowly that the body can handle that and the brain can handle that. But as soon as it starts to be stripped out and refined and then put in these packages that are not only, you know, higher amounts of sugar, but then you're often combining them with fat, which that doesn't happen in nature. You know, foods don't come high in both fat and sugar in nature. That is an evolutionarily novel, unique, highly rewarding package. And all the stuff that is protective, like the fibers and the waters, they're stripped out. And then the foods are so processed and texturized that they're almost pre-chewed for us. Think about, you know, how much longer it takes to chew an apple versus kind of a chocolate chip cookie you get out of a box. You know, it just kind of melts on the tongue and it gets into your system so much more rapidly. And all those features are what makes them enticing, appealing, makes us buy more, but also sets us up to lose control of them.
So would it be fair to say that somebody that is struggling with kicking junk food, it's not completely in their control?
Yeah, I would say if you're really struggling, you know, we need to think about in the same way we would with something like alcohol or tobacco, that we know it's really an interaction between, you know, your own individual risk factors and the substance itself. So, you know, not everybody who drinks alcohol develops an alcohol use disorder problem. You know, it's about 15%, 10 to 15% of people develop an alcohol use disorder. You know, we're seeing with our science that about 15 to 20% of individuals develop an addictive response to these foods where they're losing control, can't stop even though they want to, having these really intense cravings, and that it's really a struggle. And that I think with food, we so often just stop with, you know, calories in, calories out, you know, just try and white knuckle it, which it's a more complex psychological process that has a lot to do with reward and a motivation and emotions, and that you might need some additional support of a professional or a support group to help you really get to a point where these foods aren't starting to control your life.
How do we regulate foods here in the U.S.? And is that part of our problem that we have with some of these ultra processed foods and the way things are targeted?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel like you're very hands off in the U.S. Like we think about maybe some toxins here or there, but in general, when it comes to added sweeteners, added fats, our regulatory agencies have been very hands off, and because of our focus on free speech, there's minimal marketing restrictions, also about like kind of claims they can make about, their foods, all these nutritionism, claims about the healthfulness of the food. They're very underregulated. And we are seeing some countries starting to take steps to change the food environment that have been effective. Chile is probably one of the countries that's on the forefront that won't let there be marketing on products that are, certain food products that are not great for your health, that have really restricted marketing, that have changed, even taxing some of these foods in a way that is starting to really show benefits and their public health. The United Kingdom is making some huge strides where, they're not allowing kind of any food marketing for foods that are unhealthy before 9 p.m. so kids aren't getting as exposed to them on television. It's going to take a multifaceted approach. No single approach or policy, in the same way we saw with tobacco, is going to be a silver bullet. But we can take a package of policies and supports to change the food environment in a way that kind of sets us up for health rather than these really out of control relationships that we have with food.
It's interesting when I've looked at foods from other countries, even snack foods or sweets, they will have ingredients that are, I guess, quote unquote, healthier. And they'll have things that aren't allowed in their products versus what we have here. Mm-hmm. And I found that really interesting just because I'm like, we're America, right? Aren't we supposed to be like on top of things here?
I would say the role of money in our political system really makes that challenging. Lobbying efforts, just like we saw with tobacco, are incredibly powerful at protecting the food industry from any sort of culpability for the effects of their products. And it's frustrating and it's concerning because, the blame, just our narrative about why people are struggling, focuses so much on just shaming and blaming individuals. And it really doesn't take into account that there's a $1 trillion industry designing, engineering these products, marketing them aggressively with minimal government oversight. And that, they're making money and making profit off this. People want to be healthy. I've never treated somebody who has not tried everything under the sun to get their eating under control. And it's, we're really, I think, putting the focus and the blame on the wrong sectors.
That's true. I think, before even having the conversation with you and not knowing so much about this, I used to think like, it's just willpower. And, that's the message that everybody has. It's like, you either have it or you don't, or you need to find it. And then when learning more about just how things are designed and the addictiveness of it, it's just like, you feel like you're set up for failure.
Yes, it's, I hate to like leave with such a sort of pessimistic message. So there are things people can do, but I do think as a whole, we need to ask for better. We need to ask our government to do better. We need to ask these industries to not put their profits and, hold their profits as more important than the health of our children and our well-being. And I think there are things that we can do, but in general, I suggest that people treat themselves with a sense of like radical compassion that this is hard. Your brain is back in the Stone Age. It thinks it's going to die of famine at any moment. And our food industry is designed to take advantage of that. And so, for folks, I really suggest taking many of the strategies that we use in addiction science to help them get a handle on their food as much as they can. And that's, trying to really know what your cues and your triggers are. You're journaling about times of day, emotions, environments that are really tricky for you, and being really aware of those and trying to minimize your exposure to them, or coming up with alternative plans for how you can address them by having support or different coping strategies that aren't food related. And then, I'll really suggest with people that I think one of the big approaches that I see sets people up to fail is that people will still be eating a lot of ultra processed foods, but just trying to eat very few calories. And so that triggers that fear of the body that it's starving. And that signal that you're so, so hungry goes up to the reward center of the brain and says, hey, pay attention. We need food. We need calories. And it makes us more vulnerable to those addictive foods. And so I really suggest to folks that they don't starve themselves, that they're focusing on eating real foods that they do enjoy and eating them regularly, you know, three meals, one or two snacks a day, and that they're not letting themselves get to those points where they haven't eaten all day. They're so hungry, they're tired, they're stressed, and they're sitting down on the couch with tons of food advertising. And then it often sets them up to lose control of their eating in a way that, you know, just makes them really feel guilt and shame and then have to start all over the next day.
When it comes to the work that you are doing right now, I know you run the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab at the University of Michigan. Is there any new studies that you're looking into or things you could share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're really focusing on kids is really important to us because, you know, most and prior human history, we didn't really expose children to addictive substances as regularly, right? You know, you would maybe have your first exposure in adolescence, early adulthood. You know, if we think of these foods as having this addictive profile, you know, 80% of kids are having added sugars on a daily level. And so we really are trying to understand, you know, how are these foods impacting children even very, very early in life in a way that can be setting them up to struggle both psychologically and physically with these foods. And so, you know, again, to parents, I just add so much compassion to parents because it's really hard. And our environment is not set up for us to feed our children, to nourish them, but to feed them in a way that you profits the industry. And I think we need to understand that better so we can set up a world that lets our children have a healthier relationship with food.
Do you ever get pushback from these industries with the research that you're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, I think our messages are, you know, not ones that are appealing to the industry. My advisor in grad school is Kelly Brownell. And, you know, he kind of always told us that we really are going to have to make changes to improve our health that is not going to help the industry's bottom line. And so if you're doing stuff and that the industry isn't liking it and they're, you know, fighting against it to try and, you know, silence you or ridicule you, if anything, it probably tells you you're on the right track. And so, I really kind of have paid attention to that idea of like, I'm going to follow the science and pay attention to what the science tells us. You know, try and hold strong on what would, I think, set us up to thrive rather than worry so much about what the industry thinks about what I'm doing.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, is there any other advice you'd give to listeners who are tuning in and just wondering what the first step they can take is to a healthier life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my, you know, I guess I've said this so many times, but I just see how much people are beating themselves up with just shame and guilt. And, you know, I think the first step in many ways, it doesn't help you change often, is to, you know, just be compassionate with yourself that this is really hard, that, you know, the environment has really been set up against us. And then to hold for yourself to say, okay, what sort of food nourishes me and that I do enjoy, but I'm not in this struggle with? And think about how do you make your own personal food environment as much as you can dominated by those foods, and not letting the industry have such control over what's around you, and to, you know, approach some of those industry products with skepticism, to know that they're engineered to make it hard for you to consume those in moderation, and you know, to kind of arm yourself with that information to figure out what works best for you.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's Ashley Gearhart, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.